In China, a radical new lockdown plan, administer COVID tests to an entire megacity. Also ahead, American and Russian officials meet today with Russian troops camped at the Ukraine border.
I think the U.S. is seeking time so that it can negotiate with Russia as opposed to respond to an invasion.
And in Uganda, after 2 years, many kids are finally back in school.
And we are all really, really hopeful that we never have to have the education sector closed again.
Still, worries about long-term damage that COVID protocols may have caused. I'm Carol Hills. Plus, the world's most powerful telescope literally unfolds itself in space, with engineers watching it happen far below.
When you're a million miles away from the Earth, you can't go there to fix anything that might be wrong.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It was another brutal pandemic weekend. New York City reported 42,000 cases yesterday. In London, 16,000 positive tests. In the Chinese city of Tianjin, just 41 over both Saturday and Sunday. Not bad for a city of 14 million. Still, the government's response? Test everyone who lives there. Officials also closed schools and shut down public transportation. The World's Rebecca Kanther begins our coverage today from Shanghai.
On China's version of TikTok, videos were circulating today of streets with few cars and city residents lining up for COVID tests outside their apartment buildings. Some reported being called to line up as early as 3 a.m. TikTok user Ting Ting posted this video of long lines of people wearing heavy winter coats and double masks, stamping their feet in the cold. She's saying, "We went out at 7 a.m. to stand in line. My husband has been holding our spot for 2 hours now. He thinks there's another 2 hours to go." Then the video cuts to Ting Ting in her apartment. She's showing off the contents of her fridge, lots of small bags of vegetables. It's a good thing we did some grocery shopping over the weekend, she says. Yesterday, when we heard things were getting serious, we tried ordering online, but all the shops had stopped delivering. All my husband could get at the market were these two leeks, some turnips, and some apples, she says. Having enough food is a big concern when COVID cases rise in China. People have been paying close attention to the situation in Xi'an, another northern city that's been on strict lockdown since last month. People there still aren't allowed outside, and many have struggled to get enough food. Zhang Huazi also had trouble when she went shopping on Sunday in Tianjin. She says, "My vegetable market was shut. There's bad air circulation there, so they just closed the whole building. The vendors were selling vegetables right on the street. The supermarket was closed too. Prices are up." Zhang says COVID testing went on through the night. She says, "When we were headed to bed, we could hear the announcements over the loudspeakers down on the street. Healthcare workers were announcing, 'Come out and get tested. The lines are shorter now.'" With the Olympics less than a month away, the government has cut off train transport between Tianjin and Beijing. Travel outside the city is only allowed for people with a negative test result and permission from their school or employer. But even these strict measures haven't been enough to prevent the spread of COVID. Today, state media reported that Omicron cases have already popped up 300 miles away. Meanwhile, there's another cluster of Delta cases in southern Shenzhen and rising cases in several cities in central Henan province. People around China are coming to grips with the fact that they most likely won't be doing any traveling for the upcoming Chinese New Year holiday. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther.
American and Russian officials met in Geneva today, and the stakes couldn't be higher. The U.S. is trying to avert what could become the biggest political crisis between Russia and the West since the Cold War. We're talking about the huge buildup of Russian troops along its border with Ukraine. Will Pomeranz with the Wilson Center has been following these talks closely. He joins us now from Washington. Will Pomeranz, set up these talks for us. What led the U.S. and Russia to the negotiating table this week?
Well, it was really the actions of the Russian Federation and its unprecedented buildup of troops on the Ukrainian border. It is estimated that there's 100,000 troops or more on the Ukrainian border, and that Russia was looking for security guarantees from the United States and its NATO allies. Russia, up to date, has shown no inclination to back down, but it has demanded that certain conditions be met before it withdraws its troops.
Now let's break this down player by player. What will the U.S. be seeking in these talks?
I think the U.S. is seeking time. It is seeking time so that it can negotiate with Russia as opposed to respond to an invasion of Russia to Ukraine. So I think the United States wants to defuse this crisis, and at the same time, it wants to stand behind the integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. Those are the two objectives, and I think that is what is being emphasized in Geneva today.
Okay, on the flip side, what does Russia want to get out of the U.S.?
Russia wants certain security guarantees and also a guarantee and a statement that the United States and NATO will not expand into Ukraine. There are other different issues that are floating around, but it is this security guarantee that Russia wants and has said essentially is non-negotiable.
It seems like there's not a lot of middle ground here. I mean, Russia wants guarantees that Ukraine and other countries won't join NATO, a guarantee the U.S. can't give Russia, while the U.S. wants a stable, predictable relationship with Russia, which has not been the case so far. Are these talks doomed from the start?
Well, we are getting the preliminary results even as we speak. And one of the key factors that has emerged over these negotiations is that Russia has said that it has no intentions of escalating this crisis and invading Ukraine. Now, we have to wait and see and be sure that Russia is true to its commitments. But if indeed Russia decides not to attack, then there is time. And as I said at the beginning, time is of the essence because the United States and its European allies want to negotiate, but it also wants to stand behind Ukraine and its sovereignty.
What leverage does the U.S. have in trying to deter Russia from further aggression against Ukraine?
Our leverage is economic, primarily. President Biden has said that the United States will not become involved militarily in Ukraine, so that the only real leverage that we have is economic leverage. And there's been a variety of talk about various sort of sanctions that the United States, in conjunction with our European allies, will impose. For the United States, it would be various export controls, especially of high technology goods. For the United States and the EU together, it would be potentially kicking Russia out of the SWIFT bank messaging system. So doing so would put tremendous pressure on Russia and its ability to engage in global markets.
Of course, Ukraine is at the center of these talks, and yet Ukraine is not present at the talks. Why is that, and how does that affect the U.S. approach?
Well, the first round was requested by Russia, and it was requested to be a bilateral meeting between Russia and the United States. The later meetings will broaden that circle so that the next meeting will include the United States and our NATO allies. And the final meeting of the OSCE will include both Russia and Ukraine and other members of the OSCE. So it's an expanding circle through these negotiations. But from the Russian perspective, I think Russia wants to be perceived as a great power. Great powers do these negotiations amongst each other. And that is what Putin is really trying to emphasize, that Russia is a global power, that it is engaged in the world stage, and that the United States has to deal with Russia as an equal.
Will Pomeranz is with the Wilson Center. He's been talking with us about the U.S.-Russia negotiations today in Geneva. Thanks, Will.
Thanks very much.
In recent years, an increasing number of people from Latin America and the Caribbean have migrated from their homes. They leave for many reasons, including escaping poverty, violence, or the destruction caused by extreme weather events like hurricanes. Historically, most set out for the United States, but more and more migrants are now seeking refuge in Mexico. And as the world's Monica Campbell reports, that's been a challenge for Mexico.
Last year, a record number of people who had migrated up through Latin America stayed put in Mexico. People like Ruby. I want to stay here, he says, get my papers in Mexico. Ruby's legal status is uncertain, so he asked not to use his full name. 4 years ago, Ruby left Haiti. He was 20 then and says he was being physically attacked for being bisexual.
Y luego fui pa Chile.
He migrated to Chile. Then, last fall, traveled across 9 countries to reach the U.S. border, Texas. But he was blocked there. President Joe Biden has left in place policies first established by the Trump administration that let U.S. immigration officials turn away asylum seekers. Now, Ruby is seeking asylum in Mexico. Many others are too. More than 130,000 migrants sought asylum in Mexico last year, up from previous years. Mexico's immigration system is buckling.
Nunca me han respondido bien. Solo tiene que esperar.
I'm not getting updates about my case, Ruby says. He's waited for months in the small Mexican city of Tapachula in the state of Chiapas. It's a very low-income area. There's little work to go around. But since it's the state where Ruby applied for asylum in Mexico, it's where he must stay. And that's frustrating. Asylum seekers have been protesting in Mexico since the fall. Migrants from Haiti, Central America, and parts of Africa are asking Mexican officials to allow them to move freely around the country while they wait for progress on their cases. Haitian migrants make up the largest number of asylum seekers in Mexico, and Andres Ramirez, who leads Mexico's refugee agency, says the government should be doing more to help them.
Just give them the paper with which they could be legally in Mexico. They would have job opportunities, school for their children, and that they could be integrated legally within the Mexican society. We cannot send these people back to Haiti.
A pilot program is just starting to assist Haitians in Mexico. It's very small, though, and some advocates say it's too late. Mexico should have acted sooner. Arturo Vizcarra is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, a nonprofit. He's based in Mexico. He says the steady rise in migrants seeking asylum in Mexico should come as no surprise. The country has been more aggressive in keeping migrants from entering the United States since the Trump administration's border crackdown.
And that's the natural and obvious and already documented outcome of being an extension of the Border Patrol for the United States.
So for now, people like Ruby are waiting in limbo in Mexico.
Difficult,
he says over the phone. And he shows me the room he's renting with another young Haitian.
Es un solo cuarto que tiene dos camas.
He says it's bare bones with mattresses on the floor. He wants to work, but so do a lot of other migrants there. The other day, he says a guy pulled up in a truck and needed a dozen people to help with some construction. Ruby rushed out, but it was too late. He spends a lot of time in his room.
A veces jugamos cartas y dominos.
We play cards or dominoes, he says. In fact, Ruby's dominoes set was a gift from a friend from Haiti who was in Mexico too, but recently left to try and enter the United States once again. Ruby says that if he can't find stable footing in Mexico soon, he might do the same. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
A great day and great relief for science. We check in on the Webb Telescope just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Astronomers all over the world are cheering.
Yes.
And breathing a sigh of relief today. 1 million miles from Earth, the final components of the James Webb Space Telescope have finally unfolded in space. Each mirror, cable, wire, and motor is now in its intended place. The telescope is the most powerful space observatory ever built. Martin Barstow from the University of Leicester is helping manage the telescope. I asked him how he felt when the telescope's last mirror unfolded.
An enormous sense of relief. I mean, it's been such a nail-biting ride for the last couple of weeks since it was launched. We obviously expected it to work, but we also at the same time knew how many things could go wrong on the way, and getting through all those hurdles was really critical.
Now, according to NASA, there were literally hundreds of things that could have gone wrong with this deployment. How many critical points were there actually?
In terms of the actual mechanisms, they're right when they talk about hundreds. But for those of us who are really sort of worried about how the telescopes work, there were some really critical events. For example, the launch itself. Rockets are very, very reliable these days, but still some fail. And then the next one for us was opening the sunshade. The sunshade is really important because that allows the telescope to be cooled down. And we need to get the telescope cold to get rid of the infrared radiation that the telescope itself would generate, that's heat, and stop us from observing the distant parts of the universe. And then over the last week or so, unfolding the telescope and in particular deploying the secondary mirror that directs the light from the main mirror into the instruments, without which we actually couldn't do any observations.
Logistically, why does the telescope need to be folded up the way it is?
So the telescope, as you already said at the beginning of this item, is the largest telescope ever put into space. When it's opened out, as it is now, the mirror is 6.5 meters across. And you simply cannot get it into a rocket as a completely deployed element. You have to fold it up. So I've always thought of opening up James Webb Space Telescope as being like a butterfly coming out of a chrysalis. And out emerges this beautiful thing which unfolds its wings so that you can actually get the full aperture of that telescope available to do the astronomy.
This telescope follows in the footsteps of Hubble, another massive, powerful telescope that was launched into space in 1990. Hubble famously had problems after it was launched into space. Does that legacy loom large over the James Webb team?
It certainly does, because that was a big problem. We were fortunate we could go back to Hubble because it's in low Earth orbit and we could actually carry out some corrections to the system. When you're a million miles away from the Earth, you can't go there to fix anything that might be wrong. So we have been extremely worried about making sure everything is just perfect before launch and trying to second guess all the potential problems.
So, Martin, when will you finally breathe a sigh of relief? Will it ever happen?
It will. Actually, I've already breathed several sighs of relief. The actual deployment of the telescope and getting that sunshade open were the really, really big things that we had to get right. Now we're at the level of adjusting the telescope to get it ready to work and tuning it. I think we can say for certain we will now get science out of it, whereas before the weekend, we couldn't say that with any confidence.
It's just so incredible to imagine constructing something and then managing it from a million miles away.
I know. It gives me goosebumps every time I think about it.
Martin Barstow is a space scientist from the University of Leicester in the UK. He's the chair of the Space Telescope Institute Council, which operates the James Webb Space Telescope. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Across the United States, thousands of Afghans are still camped at military bases, waiting to settle into homes across the U.S. Many Afghan newcomers don't have a credit history or money in the bank, things that landlords often require. But some property owners are stepping up to open their doors. Connecticut Public Radio's Camila Vallejo has the story.
Thomas Kania remembers it like it was yesterday. The Connecticut real estate investor was showing his recently vacant apartment in Middletown. That's right in the center of the state. The unit is next to an elementary school and a short walk away from a bus stop, ideal for a new family. He had about 60 applications and about 20 showings just that day.
And it's been in great condition from the second it came into my possession. And as a front porch.
Demand for affordable housing is high, and it's not just in Connecticut. Across the country, rents have become too expensive for some people. And while some resettlement agencies are able to navigate this, others are relying on temporary housing like Airbnbs and hotels. Kania's grandparents came to the U.S. from Poland. So when he got a call from a resettlement agency looking to welcome a new family of six to the city, he says he didn't think twice. He offered them the apartment despite the demand.
The American spirit that my grandparents felt, it's the American spirit that subsequent generations have been able to take advantage of in my family. So I'm really happy to have someone here who basically could take advantage of the American experience. And so we welcome them as we would any other tenant.
Now, the apartment is ready to live in thanks to Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, or IRIS, one of Connecticut's two resettlement agencies. The organization provided things like beds, toiletries, and toys for children, all possible through donations. Kania shows me the kitchen. It's been stocked with essentials.
Just the basic things like cooking oil, things I would use for basically an international diet, things like rice, sugar, salt, basic seasoning.
Another landlord has also joined Kania in welcoming refugees. I met Murat Feratovic outside of one of his apartment complexes. It's about 15 miles north from Middletown. He says he's helped about 10 people resettle through IRIS in the last 2 years. And he does it because he was once in their shoes.
Also come same as them. I come from Bosnia. You come with a bag, nothing in it, and you start a life here.
Fedatović left Bosnia in 1996 during the country's civil war. He also came here with no credit history or stable income, so he knows how important it is for someone to give you a chance. He says beyond being a landlord, he tries to be a resource.
Try to point them in the right way, because this is the country where you have a lot of opportunity, but if you use it in the wrong way, that's going to hurt you. Much as I can, I help them.
Fedatović says he tries to help his tenants figure out transportation and other logistics, and it's all in collaboration with the resettlement agency. Chris George runs IRIS. He says the organization co-signs the lease, makes sure refugees pay the rent on time, and helps them find jobs. Yet there's still some hesitancy in the landlord community. That's a potential roadblock for resettlement. At a recent press conference, George made a plea.
So please, landlords, we're not asking you to put refugees to the front of the line. We just want them to be in line.
Stephen Kaplan understands the hesitancy. He's a new landlord and heard about IRIS on the radio. He says initially he had some feelings of distrust.
But thankfully, the larger portion of me is able to push those feelings down and realize that, like, these people, they were putting their lives on the line to help our soldiers and to help America. To be able to give back to them, it felt right.
Kaplan says by working with a resettlement agency, he's been able to address all of his concerns. Now he's renting to four men from Afghanistan. But Connecticut officials, like others throughout the U.S., say the state needs many more apartments for refugees in the next couple of months. For The World, I'm Camila Vallejo, New Haven, Connecticut.
More stories from around the globe are coming your way. This is The World. In Bosnia, a troubling and illegal display of nationalist identity. It has some preparing for a quick exit.
We scanned our university degree diplomas and family albums to the cloud, in case that we can, you know, at least continue our new life somewhere else outside of Bosnia.
Plus, an Argentine tango with a feminist perspective. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. After nearly 2 years of pandemic disruption, students in Uganda are finally back in their classrooms today. Uganda's school shutdowns were the longest in the world. Class may be back in session, but educators like Mary Goretti Nakabugo remain worried about the long-term toll of all those missed days. Goretti Nakabugo is the executive director of UWEZO Uganda, a nonprofit that conducts educational research. She joins us from Kampala. Mary Goretti Nakabugo, what sort of scenes did we see today across Uganda with students and teachers finally seeing one another in the classroom after nearly 2 years apart?
What we're seeing at the moment is excitement. Really, schools having been closed for the last 2 years for some classes, especially for the preschool up to primary three, those have been closed since March 2020. So there has been excitement and parents taking back their children, especially those going to boarding schools. The car parks have been kind of jammed. There has been a little bit of a slow response, especially in rural areas, but there is excitement. And we are all really, really hopeful that we never have to have the education sector closed again. So, like, the kids in my households have returned to school today. Some were already ready to go back on Sunday, and they were really excited. Some even woke up and put on their uniforms because of the excitement. But we had to wait until today because that is what the directive from government shows.
Not all Ugandan students returned to the classrooms. Who came back and who didn't?
There has been a slow start in the rural areas. So we are hopeful that by the end of this week and early next week, most kids will have returned.
Why did Uganda close its schools for so much longer than neighboring countries?
I think it was a lot of fear. A lot of fear for the unknown. I think the first time the schools really closed in March 2020, that was the right decision to really make because nobody had ever experienced this. I think the second closure, when schools tentatively reopened, and then we had a second lockdown in June 2021, we believe that that was perhaps rushed and maybe out of fear, not knowing what would happen because infections had started erupting in some schools, but that were isolated cases.
Do you think Uganda's experience with HIV and AIDS and the orphans created by the HIV virus, do you think that influenced thinking on school closures?
Well, it may, but yes or no. But I think what was being observed in other countries in Europe and elsewhere, I mean, there's so many high rates of deaths. That must have caused a lot of fear, because one thing for sure is that our health system is very weak. So I think an eruption of unimaginable numbers of cases, government feared on how we would be able to handle that. One of the closest pandemic we have had before was the Ebola case, but actually schools never closed in Uganda during the Ebola crisis some years back.
I'm reading that a lot of would-be students in Uganda, especially those in high school, have gone into the workforce or started families during the shutdown of classes. What sort of efforts are going to be made to get those students back in school?
The data on that is not comprehensive, but it's true. There are cases of kids who have gone into the world of work, not only in high school. Even some primary kids started a bit of work either at home or in the neighboring communities. And the effort that is being made is to mount national campaigns on radios, on TV, but also local leaders in communities. Kids need to know that if they add on education, that income will double, even triple, if they finish, for example, lower secondary education.
Are you at all worried that there could be COVID outbreaks in schools? I know that classrooms can be quite crowded, especially for young kids in Uganda.
Yeah, I think we cannot rule that out even before the pandemic. There was overcrowding in many, many, many schools. It's quite difficult, even adults, to put on a mask for 8 hours nonstop. I think the creative use of the space, the outdoor space, is going to be very critical. But what we have learned previously is that even during the second lockdown in June 2021, not every school was affected. So I think this is a time where we have to look at case by case. If there is a school which has been highly affected, maybe we close that school and attend to the children. But otherwise, I think closing the education sector because of some cases here and there may not help. We are happy that the schools have now reopened. And let us all put our heads and hands together to ensure that children are learning and nobody's left behind.
Mary Goretti Nakabugo directs Uwezo Uganda, a nonprofit that conducts educational research. She spoke to us from Kampala to tell us about the reopening of Uganda's classrooms after nearly 2 years of pandemic-prompted closures. Thanks a lot, Mary.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
A quick update to a story we've been following. In Myanmar today, a court sentenced Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 more years in prison. The 76-year-old Nobel Peace Laureate had already been convicted and sentenced to 2 years in jail. The ousted leader also faces a dozen more charges that could amount to a century behind bars. Suu Kyi's supporters and independent analysts say the charges against her are contrived and meant to give legitimacy to the military, which seized power in Myanmar last February. This weekend in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bosnian Serbs defied the courts. They marked a public celebration that's been outlawed. The nationalist celebration marks the creation of an autonomous state back in 1992. That ignited a nearly 4-year war, which led to some 100,000 people being killed. The celebration also came just days after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Bosnian Serb leader Milorad Dodik for trying to restore the Bosnian Serb military. Joining us from Sarajevo to talk about all this is Hikmet Karc. He's the author of a forthcoming book called Torture, Humiliate, Kill, Inside the Bosnian Serb Camp System. Hikmet, what was your reaction when you saw the celebrations yesterday?
Well, it was a very awful feeling because, you know, the celebration of the start of basically the announcement of the genocide in 1982, but also when you see military equipped personnel walking around parading with flags, with insignia, which resonates the genocide which was committed some 25 years ago, it's not a really great feeling as a Bosniak, as a Bosnian Muslim, to see all of this on TV.
Were you surprised, or have you seen this coming all along?
Well, I mean, this date has been celebrated for the last decade, basically, but not all the time in the same fashion. But in the last 2 or 3 years, the celebrations have been much more radicalized. And this year, what the most shocking part was that there were Russian paramilitaries also taking part in this parade, the so-called Night Wolves, which is a sort of private army of the Russian state, which causes problems throughout the region.
Can you remind us briefly who the Bosnian Serb nationalists are and what they hope to achieve?
So in the peacetime, in the last 25 years, the Bosnian Serb politicians, along with support from the Serbian state, they have managed to create a chaos and a political anarchy in Bosnia, again, with the help not only of the Russians and the Chinese, but also far-right nativist actors from Europe and also from across the Atlantic, in order to create the goals which they did not succeed militarily.
You mentioned you're Bosniak, you're Muslim. What's the feeling in the country right now among Bosnia's Muslims and Croatians?
Well, actually, we Bosnian Muslims feel very, very much afraid and quite actually uncomfortable knowing that we are right now on our own, basically, because we have the Russians supporting the Bosnian Serbs in Serbia, and we're not getting that kind of support from the EU, from NATO, and from the United States. Since we consider ourselves allies of Europe and of the United States, we're expecting more help and more siding with us at this moment right now.
How do you think this can be resolved?
Drastic measures in the sense that NATO and the European Union or Great Britain and the US should actually focus more on Bosnia right now, because whatever happens in Bosnia can spill over very quickly to Serbia, to Montenegro, to Macedonia, to Kosovo, and so on. So this is going to be very quickly become a very regional issue. And secondly, to bring in some sort of troops to the country in order to make a countermeasure to the rising Russian influence in Serbia and in the Bosnian Serb Republic.
You think NATO troops should come in?
We have passed the point of any sort of peaceful dialogue, I think, currently. And what you're going to see is probably the Bosnian state being carved up into two parts in the long run. So in order to save ourselves, I think we're going to need to have NATO troops here.
That's a pretty dire prediction. So you think there's no chance at all of any dialogue?
I mean, look, we're currently in a situation where the Bosnian Serbs are celebrating war criminals who were convicted of genocide. So 25 years ago, the Bosnian Serb army committed a genocide in eastern Bosnia. And today what we are having is we're having the revival of this army, of this police, which massacred and raped women in camps. You know, as a Bosniak Muslim, I would love to have some other point of view. But in all honesty, what can we expect? I mean, if nothing has been resolved in the last 25 years, we can only hope for the best, but we should expect the worst, basically.
You mentioned on Twitter that you've been uploading your personal documents to the cloud. Can you tell us why you're doing that?
Well, look, in 1982, my dad took family albums, photographs of our family and university degree, diplomas, and so on, because our family's experience from the Second World War taught us that having family photographs is a memory that we all cherish. And of course, university diplomas and money and gold is something which is important for you to survive later on as a refugee. And this is something which helped him out in 1982 when we were expelled from our home. So today, of course, we don't need to carry around family albums anymore, but we can scan and upload it all to the cloud. And that's exactly what my wife and I did. We scanned our university degree diplomas and family albums to the cloud, and also our passports. So, you know, in case that things go south, that we can, you know, at least continue our new life somewhere else outside of Bosnia.
Hikmet Karcic is a Bosnian academic and researcher and the author of a forthcoming book called Torture, Humiliate, Kill, Inside the Bosnian Serb Camp System. He joined us from Sarajevo. Thanks a lot, Hikmet.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
When you think of Argentine culture, what's the first thing that pops into your mind? Take a moment. I'll wait. Soccer? Empanadas? Or perhaps the tango. Argentine tango is celebrated and romanticized the world over, but the tango has always been historically male-dominated. Its lyrics can be particularly sexist. But now a new generation of female and queer tango musicians are trying to change that. The World's Lucia Benavides has that story.
Patricia Malanca always dreamed of writing a tango album full of feminist songs, a rarity in the tango world.
Un poco mi intención es tratar de llegar a los lugares.
My intention is to have my songs heard in places where the traditional sexist tango persists, she says of her newest album, which came out late last year.
Hay fiesta rosa en la vieja casona.
Each song in Malanka's album is an ode to a novel written by a contemporary female Argentine author, touching on topics such as abortion rights and trans identity.
Después, las mujeres letristas y cantautoras que estamos generando una nueva poética.
She says women lyricists like her are bringing about a change in the tango world by writing songs about equality and social issues. Malanka says classical tango songs often normalize gender violence or devalued women. Even Carlos Gardel, considered the father of tango, sung about keeping women in their place. The roots of tango date back to the late 19th century, when Buenos Aires was a cultural mix of indigenous people, former enslaved Afro-Argentines, and recently arrived migrants predominantly from Italy and Spain. It was a very patriarchal world, says tango historian Francisco Palumbo.
Buenos Aires tenía en su conformación demográfica una población mayoritariamente masculina.
He says the population of Buenos Aires was around 70% male, mainly because of all the migrants, and that was reflective in tango songs. But by the early 20th century, Palumbo says, some women had worked their way into the spotlight, like Paquita Bernardo, who played the bandoneón, a small type of accordion typical in tango, and Rosita Quiroga, a guitarist who sung in the first tango ever recorded in Argentina in 1926, La Musa Mistonga.
La Musa Mistonga de los arrabales, La Mistonga, Musa de raro lenguaje, que abrevo las aguas de los madrigales.
Over the past 100 years, women's participation in tango music has slowly increased. And now, Palumbo says, it's a particularly special moment.
Bueno, hasta que llegamos al momento actual, donde rescatan otro espacio para la mujer, donde...
He says women are creating new spaces for themselves in the tango world. There's an increase of all-female and all-queer tango groups playing new songs with a feminist lens. One of them is La Empoderosa Orquesta Típica, the empowered atypical orchestra. And they cover songs like Pendeja, about a young girl who was forced to carry out a pregnancy after being raped. Composer Cynthia Trigo said she wrote the song to highlight the importance of abortion access, which was illegal in Argentina until December 2020.
Empecé a notar cómo a partir de un movimiento que se empezó a dar luego de Ni Una Menos y toda la campaña.
She says this type of tango has been influenced by the latest wave of feminism in Argentina that took hold in 2015 after a high-profile case of femicide. For Trigo, who's been in the industry for nearly 20 years, the emergence of feminist tango collectives helped her feel less alone. She often collaborates with other female and trans musicians.
Lo que vos contesta cuando viene a Argentina es eso no es honesto en relación a lo que el tango es.
Trigo says the tango usually presented to international markets is not a genuine representation of what tango really is. A constantly evolving musical genre that's spearheaded by underground artists. She says feminist tango is growing, and it's only a matter of time before audiences catch up. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides.
Yo no soy mina de nadie, enrolla ese collarcito. A mí no me cierra el pico, ni tu puño ni tu ley. Te creíste la del macho, estás un poco.
Followers of the Taoist goddess Mezu come from all over the world to visit her temple on Meizhou Island off the coast of China. Our correspondent in Shanghai, Rebecca Canther, witnessed some of the celebrations herself and snapped some colorful images. You should really check them out. They're at our website, theworld.org. An interim government is supposed to be just that, interim. In the West African nation of Mali, however, the military junta is proposing holding the next national election in 5 years. West Africa's major economic bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, is not buying into that. And the body held an emergency meeting yesterday to discuss what to do. Reporter Ridwan Dini Osman was in Accra in Ghana covering the ECOWAS meeting. What is ECOWAS? And have they always considered democracy important?
ECOWAS is the Economic Community of West African States. It has 15 members and it was set up in the 1970s to build economic cooperation between West African countries. Now, what's interesting about the group of countries politically is that many are in what some observers have called the coup belt, because between 1958 and 2008, they had the highest number of political coups on the continent. And ECOWAS actually has a history of standing up for democracy and trying to punish authoritarian government.
Ridwan, first of all, remind us how long the military has been in charge in Mali.
All right. So in August 2020 in Mali, there was a military coup that toppled the president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. When that happened, ECOWAS suspended Mali from the regional bloc and imposed a travel ban that included freezing the assets of members of the transitional government of that country. And so when Colonel Goita delayed elections again, ECOWAS had an emergency meeting. And when the meeting was over, the president of the ECOWAS Commission, Jean-Claude Kassibru, came out and announced what they were going to do.
Freeze of assets of the Republic of Mali in ECOWAS central banks. Freeze of assets of the Malian state and the state enterprises in all commercial banks.
ECOWAS has also kind of shut the borders so people can't cross back and forth. Isn't that likely to affect workers in Mali?
It certainly will. Experts argue that measures may inflict significant damage to the Sahel state, which is already mired in poverty and fighting a jihadist insurgence. Now, the closure of land and air borders has already impacted travelers. However, experts say we can expect a cash crisis.
There are economic partnerships like ECOWAS on every continent. The members are sometimes a mix of democratic and authoritarian governments. Does ECOWAS stand out for trying to fight for democracy in its member countries?
It certainly does, and also because they've been able to handle similar issues in the past. It remains an open question whether Mali's other international partners will now follow the lead of ECOWAS in pressuring the junta. Analysts say such a move would further tighten the screws and that they won't be surprised if pro-army demonstrations take place in Bamako over the next few days, which is the capital of Mali. But ECOWAS has said that these sanctions, which take effect immediately, will be lifted gradually only when the Malian authorities present an acceptable timeline and satisfactory progress. The delayed return of Mali to civilian rule has put the bloc's credibility on the line as it seeks to uphold fundamental principles of governance and contain regional stability. And so this is really crucial for ECOWAS.
Ridwan Karim Dini Osman is a reporter in Ghana. Ridwan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
China's rise has many of its neighbors nervous, including Japan. Japan's post-war constitution prevents the country from developing forces that could wage war. Nevertheless, Japan's military is growing in the name of self-defense. Troops are now posted in the most remote parts of the country. Noah Snyder, the Tokyo bureau chief of The Economist magazine, reports on how they are trained and armed.
I was traveling in the southwest of Japan along an island chain called the Nansei. I went, in fact, all the way out to the edge of this island chain, to an island called Yonaguni. It's a tiny little rocky speck of an island at the edge of the East China Sea. And as you fly, you get this really sweeping view of the islands. I mean, obviously, gorgeous open seas and a gorgeous view onto the edge of the Pacific Ocean. And really, as we flew, it hit me just how vast a territory this is. We're talking about dozens of islands, some of them inhabited, others not. Yonaguni was the site of the first of a number of military bases and installations that Japan's self-defense forces, as its military is called, have opened across the Nansei Islands in recent years. So what's gotten people worried recently is two things. Number one is China's aggression and China's intentions, especially with regards to Taiwan. And the other force that's got people a bit worried is questions about America's reliability. You know, Japan is in many ways dependent on America for its security. The U.S.-Japan alliance is the bedrock of its defense strategy. But people are starting to wonder about America's commitment. And those dual forces have really prompted a big transformation in Japan's own security posture in recent years. This new posture really means two things. It means strengthening Japan's own defenses, so building up bases and investing more in defense. And it also means building up ties with security partners other than America. I went and visited the base of a unit called the Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade, which is kind of modeled essentially on the American Marine Corps. But basically, they've taken a few thousand elite soldiers and started to train them for recapturing islands for amphibious-based operations. They've got a big pool set up where they do all kinds of drills to practice what would happen if their troop carriers capsized in the middle of the ocean and they had to escape. They've got scout swimmers out there practicing, learning how to swim in the ocean with 45-kilogram packs in order to infiltrate behind enemy lines on island territories. I think Japan is clearly a lot more up for the rough and tumble geopolitics it finds itself faced with now than it was a decade or two ago. At the same time, this shift is clearly a work in progress, and there's really not a consensus yet about where Japan's red lines lie and how Japan ought to respond. So Japanese leaders now have the tools to act. They have the ability to do quite a lot more than they used to be able to, but it will still be a political decision to use those tools.
The economist Noah Snyder on Japan's military buildup, speaking to our partners at the Economist podcast, The Intelligence. The World broadcasts from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow.